This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
I'm David Aronovich. Welcome to The Briefing Room, the metaversal mind chamber where you, me, the top experts and a big subject collide and then resolve for 28 minutes. This week, the Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has promised urgent action to tackle the NHS crisis. But what are the quick fixes? Are there any quick fixes to problems like chronic staff shortages, the thousands of bed blockers and the backlog of people waiting for surgical procedures? Right now, on almost any measure, the National Health Service is experiencing a crisis. We can all debate long-term solutions, but just for this week, I want to know if there are any quick fixes to get us through our current predicament. Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, let's put some numbers to and explanations for the difficulties besetting the NHS and take a look too at how they compare to those in other similar countries. With me now in the briefing room are Annabel Collins, a senior correspondent with the Health Service Journal. She's with me in the studio. And joining us from Paris is Mark Pearson, who's an international health expert with the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. Annabel Collins, I think we need to try and define the central problem that the NHS is facing right now. So let's start with the stats. Where are the key stats on NHS performance going?
Some stats were released this morning, and this has shown a record number of patients delayed for over 12 hours in A&E departments from the decision to admit to admission. That's now at 54,500 patients, and this is up from 37,000 patients the previous month. And if you compare this to December 2021, you're looking at 12,900 patients. We go back to before the pandemic, about 2,000 patients. So a really dramatic increase. If you're looking at the four-hour target, 95% of patients seen within 4 hours, we're now looking at, well, the lowest since records began. Now over half of patients, type 1 admissions into A&E, are being seen within 4 hours. In terms of ambulance times, we're now seeing the longest time since records began again.
These figures are all for England. Are the stats broadly similar for other parts of the United Kingdom?
Yes, I'd say they are broadly similar. Other parts of the United Kingdom are experiencing the same levels of pressure.
Mark Pearson, are they seeing broadly the same kinds of things on the continent?
Well, there's no question that all health systems in Europe, indeed across the entire Northern Hemisphere this winter, are under strain. COVID, flu, respiratory virus, they're all present in many, many countries. And health systems are in the news across all of Europe. That said, the European health systems are coping better. And indeed, the English experience in particular is being held up by the health sector, journalists, politicians, as something to be avoided across Europe.
So are they not also seeing significant extra weights? Are they not having big ambulance problems? Are they not having a significant backlog of operations?
It varies from country to country. I mean, I should say one of the great problems that we have here is that lots of countries don't really collect waiting list information. Of the ones that do, it tends to be Scandinavia and Southern Europe. And at the end of the pandemic, UK was roughly in the middle there, worse than the Scandinavians, worse than the Netherlands, but better than Southern Europe. But the big increase, as Annabelle's mentioned, has really been since the pandemic, the lockdowns finished in COVID, and we've not seen anything like the same sorts of increases in most countries. But that said, there are cases of long delays in emergency departments. It's becoming a political issue in countries like Canada and France, and indeed ambulance delays are a big issue in Italy. So you've seen some of the same sorts of issues, but maybe not in such an extreme way.
Annabelle, let's talk causes. We've talked stats. Is this happening because of an increased level of patient demand?
This is definitely part of the problem, but I would say this is actually a result of a long-term deterioration in the NHS over the last decade. And you can see over the last 10 years that key targets the NHS is supposed to meet have not met. We saw the key cancer target fall in 2014, the four-hour A&E wait target I mentioned earlier in 2015, and the elective wait, you're meant to only wait 18 weeks for your routine treatment, that fell in 2016. So this is the crescendo to a pattern of decline that we've seen over quite a few years.
Is this a particularly bad winter?
I think this is a particularly bad winter. We had some very cold weather in December, but also we do not have enough staff in hospitals to look after the number of people who are attending. We've seen a rise in flu cases, which is very significant. COVID is less of a problem, but we're seeing more people unwell with flu and also, of course, other respiratory viruses as well. It's not just about flu. We have poorer herd immunity after 2 years, you know, not mixing. That's definitely a significant factor. We're seeing people coming in sicker because they have been waiting at home, unable to access treatment, unable to get a GP appointment. It's all these factors interacting at the same time that is causing this very difficult situation.
So overall, would you make the judgment that this is a capacity rather than a demand problem?
Yes, it's absolutely capacity. We've seen a reduction in beds over the last 10 years. We now have about 100,000 general and acute beds in the NHS, and this is down about 10,000 beds. It's about capacity, it's also about poor flow. We have a very high percentage of people who are what's referred to as medically fit to be discharged, but they are stuck in hospital beds.
How many of those are there?
So we're looking at around 13,000 people. So that's 13% of all patients in general and acute beds are well enough to go home. But the problem here is with social care. We don't have enough capacity in social care. We don't have enough social care staff, community staff, so patients can go home with a package of care. We're also quite interesting statistic around what we call super stranded patients, so patients who have been in hospital for over 3 weeks. So that makes up nearly 20% of the general and acute bed. And it's important to say that some of those patients need to be there, but not all of them do. Some of them could be discharged.
Super stranded is a new word for me. Mark, let's again look at the comparisons with other countries. Are they experiencing the same general problems of things like flow through and so on?
Well, the bed blocking issue certainly exists in other countries, but they are in a much, much stronger position, really, because the social care system generally works much better than in England. So, for example, you know, Spain and the Netherlands currently very rapidly expanding the capacity of social care and what's called intermediate care, where people go after operations, but they don't need intensive surveillance, to free up more hospital beds. And in countries like Norway, Australia, Sweden, they're investing a huge amount to improve coordination between social and healthcare to make sure that flow goes more smoothly. These are options that aren't really possible in England because the social care system really is underperforming massively compared to other countries. And it's one of the major reasons why other health systems are coping better.
Annabel, we've talked there about mostly about patients. Let's now look at staff. Looking at England, which is where your area of expertise is, what are the latest figures for staffing in England and shortages?
So we have a 10% vacancy rate, and this has remained fairly stable over the last few years. The nursing vacancy rate is actually of greatest concern. That's now a 12% vacancy rate. That's not far off 48,000 vacant nursing posts in England. I think it's also important to say some of the worst shortages are felt in community care. We've halved the number of district nurses working in England over the last 10 years. And these are roles that are crucial in getting people out of hospital, as I said before.
So we've halved the number of community nurses. Mm. So who does the things that they used to do?
So the nurses that are left working in the system are having to do more. And they're stretched very thin. Therefore, stress levels are high, sickness levels are high, and they're covering, fewer staff are covering more patients, meaning patients get less good care. So it's bad for everybody.
And what about retention?
Retention is of huge concern. I think it's probably one of the biggest concerns in the NHS at the moment. I was looking at some of the data that was actually out last week around voluntary resignations, and it's reaching another record high. We're seeing a record number of NHS staff resigning, over 40,000. And that's for lots of different reasons, but one of the most common reasons given is work-life balance. Another is pay and reward, and that's, of course, reflected in some of the industrial action we're seeing as well.
Mark, is that a similar problem to other countries?
It is. There's a global shortage of health workers. Rich countries have not been training enough doctors and nurses. So shortages of doctors is a massive political issue in France, for example. Lots of talk of medical deserts where there's no doctors or clinics for miles around. But it is worse in the UK. The UK has 3 doctors per 1,000 people. The EU average is 4 doctors per 1,000 people, a third more. In countries like Germany and Spain, it's 4.5, 4.6, so 50% more doctors than in the UK. Even in France, for all the problems I mentioned, they have about 10% more doctors than in the UK proportionally. And the UK did have a big increase between 2010 and 2020. You know, the number of doctors went up from 2.7 to 3. But the European average increase was twice as big.
Mark, it may seem like a ridiculously big question, but broadly, how have they managed to do what we haven't?
Well, they do spend more. Basically, they have been spending more on health over time than the UK has, especially since about 2010. And that means that they can afford to have more nurses and more doctors.
Annabel, there's been a big fuss this week about excess deaths, which is deaths greater than we would normally expect in an average year. And they appear to be quite big. Can we say with any confidence that one factor in this is failures in the NHS?
I think experts are certainly saying that NHS pressures are contributing to excess deaths. Excess deaths are quite difficult to unpick, as you have to take in a lot of different factors, including demographic changes over time. But we're seeing very high bed occupancy in the NHS, staff shortages. As we talked about before, extreme pressures in A&E, people waiting a very, very long time in A&E. It would be surprising if those factors didn't have an impact.
Annabel Collins there with Mark Pearson. So, right now, them's the problems. What right now can we do to make them less severe? With me in the studio are Sally Warren, Director of Policy at the King's Fund, Professor Jill Manthorpe of King's College London, and Nigel Edwards, Chief Executive of the Nuffield Trust. So, Nigel, if I could start with you, are there any quick fixes to reduce pressure through primary care? I mean, I'm thinking mostly whether there are things that GPs can do to take the pressure off hospitals.
One of the problems that GPs have at the moment is that they're so busy seeing patients that the space and time they've got to make changes to the way their surgeries operate is really limited. There's a lot of really good ideas and policies that have been put in place over the last few years to bring pharmacists and physiotherapists and administrative staff into general practice. GPs spend quite a bit of time organising tests and investigations on behalf of the hospitals. They're asked to sign fit notes and sick notes for people, and they do repeat prescribing. A number of these things can be done by either administrative staff or by pharmacists or other professionals, but incorporating them into these surgeries and getting them working effectively is quite a task, takes a bit of time.
Sally, you're nodding. Is that how you see it, that actually your capacity to do anything significant is pretty limited, but there are things you might do around the edges.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Nigel's right. So it takes time and effort to make sure that admin staff and the receptionist understand how best to navigate patients through those different clinical specialties.
I take it that part of those pathways are the question of a successful triage. Maybe, Nigel, you should just very briefly explain what triage is and how it might be improved.
By triage, what we mean is when you contact a surgery, you're probably asked a set of questions. In the best examples of this, this might be captured by a form on the web, hopefully not too long a form, or you may be asked some key questions by someone you speak to. You then should be rung back by a senior clinician who will then talk to you about what's the most appropriate mode of treatment. Should you come in? Should you go and see a pharmacist, see the nurse, or can we deal with you on the phone? Again, it's quite a lot of work, but if you can make it work, there's some very impressive results about being able to deal with demand in a much calmer and more organised way than many surgeries currently do it.
You can't just say to the GPs now, Sally, be bolder, because we've got a real problem right now.
Well, GPs and their teams will be seeing a huge amount of risk every day, that they're making very difficult decisions in every single appointment. They're having to think through what the information on online form, does that person need a GP appointment face-to-face, virtual, can they be seen by a nurse? And they'll obviously be really concerned that they don't want to miss something. They don't want to miss a symptom that could be an early indication of a very serious disease. So I think the boldness, we need to understand there is clinical risk kind of everywhere in the system where a whole system is under this kind of pressure. There's no easy option.
Sally, let's now talk about getting people out of hospital. We've heard the statistics of 13,000 people in hospital who don't really need to be there, but who can't be moved on. So let's concentrate on the question of how you would get people out of hospital. We'll talk about social care separately with Jill, but what role is there to get people out of hospital in primary care?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So there's definitely challenges around wider community health services. So that could be primary care. It could be district nurses, where although the individual may no longer need the medical intervention that's from a hospital, they still need health intervention as well. And there are capacity challenges across community health, just as there are right across the acute sector. There are some solutions already being put in place. So one of them is around virtual wards. This is a way to support people either before they've needed to be admitted to hospital by looking after them in their normal place of home, or once they've left hospital, it's a way to kind of make sure they're being regularly monitored. Every day a clinician is looking at their results, be that blood pressure, etc. And that allows them to see, is their condition deteriorating, and might mean that they need different types of support. It's also potential for primary care practitioners, GPs or advanced nurses to be supporting people who have been moved into care homes who might need more health support in the first few weeks out of hospital as well.
Let me understand a virtual ward a little bit better. I'm at home.
Yeah.
And somebody is somehow checking up on my vital signs and all these other kind of things in a way they might do if I'm in hospital. Is that right?
Yes, that's absolutely right. So you're supported to stay in your own home or a care home if that's your usual place of residence. And you're given equipment to help you be able to measure things like your blood pressure, pulse oximeters. And every day that information needs to get submitted, normally through a digital app. A clinician looks at that every day, and through looking at those vital stats, they can see how is your condition deteriorating. We implemented a lot of virtual wards during COVID, because what was happening is people's oxygen levels were dipping really, really low before people really realised just how ill they were. So there's a commitment to roll out thousands of virtual ward places, which is a really positive thing. But again, as we kind of keep coming back to, these are complex pathways to implement, complex conditions and risk being managed. So it's not something you can just turn on overnight. But we did see during COVID, you can do some of these things with quite some pace.
Jill, are there other things that can be improved within hospitals to make discharges happen more quickly?
Yes, certainly. I think what the sector would really like is a little bit more streamlining of discharge policies. These vary hugely between and within local authorities and individual practices. We need well-equipped discharge teams. They've really got to make decisions and get the trust of everybody involved that perhaps going home early is the best thing to do.
Is there an increased role for care assessors? How might they help?
Well, care assessors can be a variety of job roles, but let's call them care assessors. People might be trusted to go into a hospital and make a decision with people about where that person might be usefully discharged to, maybe back home to something like a virtual ward, or maybe just home to relatives and so on. Or perhaps saying that a home care service in this area will be able to provide the type of support the person needs.
And that's not routine yet?
It varies. Prior to coming here today, I consulted with people in the sector and I've talked to somebody running a medium to large care home service. They have every day 100 places in their care homes that could be providing overnight 24-hour care or indeed daycare, but the local authorities don't inevitably know where those homes are and what they can offer. So we've got to get closer working between care homes, home care and indeed the NHS, both primary care and the acute sector. Perhaps the offer that needs to be on the table also is that the acute sector will not abandon you if you go to social care. It will offer a relationship, it will offer a phone number, you will not have to queue in A&E if you're in great distress. So making that offer that if there's an early discharge to wherever you're going social care, that you have still some links with the hospital that has sent you.
Nigel, you're nodding very vigorously,
yes.
So you agree with that. But what do you have to put in place to ensure that you can actually fulfil those guarantees?
It's a matter of when you're discharged, you basically have the phone number of the ward from whom you were discharged, and you would phone that number and they would find the relevant specialty registrar and they would have a conversation with you. And if you need to come in, you come straight in and you don't go via the emergency department. It's another administrative challenge, but it's certainly doable.
Nigel, of course, people may not want to be moved out of hospitals onto these virtual wards, or their relative might not want them to, or to take those care packages. Is that actually a problem?
It can be a problem, particularly if you're going to be picking up the costs of the care home. There's quite an incentive to stay in the hospital where it's free. If you're in some other countries in Europe, that wouldn't be happening. You would be moved, or you would be paying. But here, you can actually hang on for quite a long time and wait. I'm not sure how big a problem is. I think the bigger problem is probably the complexity of the system that Jill is describing there. And one of the solutions that I've seen in some parts of the world is to kind of create control rooms where people actually have a real-time map of all of the capacity that they've got in their system, so that you know that there's a place in care home X and you can get onto the hospital and go in hot pursuit, as it were, of the patient and pull them out and put them in a more appropriate setting.
Can that now be done quickly?
Sorting out administrative complexity is never something that is that easy to do. But I would have thought that that type of approach could be done relatively quickly. I mean, the problem is we seem to discover winter in January, as opposed to putting some of this place in advance.
Sally, what about the plan that some people have thought up about using hotels to take some of the capacity?
The care hotel idea is an interesting one, but again, it's kind of suggesting that the issue is the physical number of beds across the health and care system rather than the issue being about the number of health and care workers we have. It's definitely a idea about physical space, but I've yet to see where the magic workforce tree is going to deliver the staff needed for the care hotels.
Jill, I take it the social care workers actually require less training than people do in other sections of the health service. Does that mean that we can actually get them in quicker?
Well, if you're a nurse working in adult social care, you are exactly the same training as a nurse working in the NHS or privately. If you're a person who perhaps is a care worker, you'll require some induction, preparation. But yes, those people are less trained in terms of years of service. And another thing is that many people working in social care services are employed on a part-time basis, some of them for quite small numbers of hours, and perhaps we can persuade them to work more or perhaps more flexibly. Perhaps people might be willing to take on extra shifts if the money is better.
Nigel.
It's worth saying that, of course, this sector is becoming increasingly competitive. We're competing with retail and hospitality, all of whom are bidding for staff in this area. So we're seeing Lidl and Sainsbury's and Aldi all offering rates which are significantly higher than those available in the care sector. So that's a problem, because this is the same staff that are being competed for.
What we have to do for the social care employers, who are very like GPs in a way, many of them are small businesses and so on, is to make some offers around underwriting costs. If you are going to recruit new staff, existing staff to work some overtime, or even people who perhaps recently retired from your service, you've got to have the financial flex to be able to pay them.
Sally.
The government has announced two pots of money for this winter, which broadly could be used by local authorities and social care providers to pay for more overtime. The challenge is, though, that money stops in March. So if you're a provider, do you employ more people, not knowing that you've got money after March to be able to carry on employing them? Or do you just rely on the current staff you have and hope that they're going to do more overtime? The staff are exhausted. They've been through the COVID pandemic. There's going to be a limit to how much overtime your current team can do. So a short-term fix that would be a better short-term fix would be to not have this constant kind of set of short-term pots of money. Every winter, we give the NHS and social care short-term pots of money. By the time you're doing it every winter, it would just be better to give them the money year after year after year so they can make decisions that mean they can genuinely recruit more people.
So that would help us for the next crisis, presuming that we overcome this crisis and it just doesn't become one long crisis. But now, would it help to say that you were doing that in order to get staff in now?
Yes, it would. If government could say now, we are going to continue the 500 million that was announced in September that's meant to stop in March. If you were to say we're going to continue that in April, if they were to say that now, that would give providers confidence that they could recruit more staff now and they'd have the financials to be able to pay them in April. So yeah, I think it would help.
Sally, is the NHS, I mean, we all know what the old platitude is, which is it's overmanaged, but actually I'm not sure the statistics actually bear that out. Is the NHS currently actually undermanaged? And if it is, that's part of the problem. Can you do anything about it quickly?
Absolutely. I think the NHS is undermanaged. We seem to take great pride in saying around 2% of the NHS budget is spent on management and admin. But actually, management and admin of a £150 billion system is really important. It's hugely complex to get the right patient in the right operating theatre with the right clinical team, with the right test results, with the right bed available to support them when they get out. That doesn't happen overnight. And you don't want clinicians spending their time doing that. You want expert managers who can run operational systems to make sure the hospital is working really well. It's a really important job. We have some of the lowest spend if you compare us to other international healthcare systems. So I think we are undermanaged. I think we're also underinvested in our admin systems. So I'm sure pretty much all of us would have a story about getting letters from hospitals about appointments. I don't get letters in any other part of my life other than through the NHS. Can you do something really quickly about that? I think you could probably recruit quite quickly because the broader economic situation means I'm sure people would want to work in the NHS. But as we keep coming back to it, running hospitals, running urgent and emergency care pathways across ambulances is really, really complex. Learning about that is not going to be an overnight thing. But if you start to do it now, you could well have a really, really high performing management structure for next winter. But it's not going to be the answer for sort of next week and 2 weeks later.
Nigel, I was struck by some figures that came out this week about how one success area is a reduction in the backlog for operations. But on the other hand, you couldn't help asking yourself whether, given the scale of the crisis we've actually got in A&E and ambulances, etc., that actually reducing the backlog maybe shouldn't be a priority and it's getting in the way. Should we abandon it for the moment?
I really fundamentally disagree with that point of view. People are waiting for elective surgery for things which are often altering their ability to function, preventing them from working or being a carer, causing them chronic pain, and they're getting worse while they're waiting very often. So it's going to cost you more to fix it at the end. It's a false economy.
Sally?
Yeah, just to add to what Nigel said, I think one of the other consequences if you were to pause elective procedures and pause tackling the backlog would be, what happens to those patients on those waiting lists? Their need is going to turn up somewhere else in the system. So if you're waiting in pain and your operation gets delayed, possibly for 6-9 months, you're going to be turning up to your GP because you need help managing pain. You may well be turning up to A&E. The real challenge we have right now is this isn't just one part of the system that's under pressure. It's all parts of the system. It's what's happening in the acute sector. It's what's happening in urgent emergency care. It's what's happening in general practice and in social care.
Well, I'm going to ask you for overall judgments now. Firstly, do you think that if we were to implement almost all these quick fixes that we've talked about, that we could make a significant dent on the problem we've got within the next few weeks? Sally?
No, would be my simple answer. Because I think, as we've talked through, even the quick fixes aren't super, super quick. They are probably medium term. They kind of might have an impact later this year, but not in the next couple of weeks.
Jill.
So quick fixes might make a little bit of difference. We've got to keep morale up and they may help build trust, but overall it won't really dent that figure.
Nigel, are we going to be having the same conversation next year?
Unless we stop the short-term approach, the little bits of money that are time-limited, the attempt to try and do quick fixes rather than do fundamental rethinking of how some of the systems work, which has been a feature of the whole approach to this area for the last 15 or 20 years, I'm afraid so. And I'm very tired of saying the same things every year for 20 years. And I fear that unless we have that change, we'll be back here next year doing it again.
That was Nigel Edwards with Jill Manthorpe and Sally Warren. My thanks to them and to Mark Pearson and Annabel Collins. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Rosamund Jones, Kirsty Knight and Daniel Gordon. The editor was Richard Varden and the programme was mixed by Rod Farker. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon, but if you enjoyed it, you can subscribe to our podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, where you'll find a whole back catalogue to listen to, including the one on how we deal with an ageing population, the one about how House of Lords reform might work, or the one looking at how the war in Ukraine might turn out.
Nature Bang.
Hello.
Hello.
And welcome to Nature Bang.
I'm Becky Ripley.
I'm Emily Knight.
And in this series from BBC Radio 4, we look to the natural world to answer some of life's big questions.
Like, how can a brainless slime mould help us solve complex mapping problems?
And what can an octopus teach us about the relationship between mind and body?
It really stretches your understanding of consciousness.
With the help of evolutionary biologists.
I'm actually always very comfortable comparing us to other species.
Philosophers.
You never really know what it could be like to be another creature.
And spongeologists. Is that your job title? Are you a spongeologist?
Well, I am in certain spheres.
It's science meets storytelling.
With a philosophical twist.
It really gets to the heart of free will and what it means to be you.
So if you want to find out more about yourself,
via cockatoos that dance, frogs that freeze, and single-cell amoebas that design border policies,
subscribe to Nature Bang from BBC Radio 4, available on BBC Sounds. Bang!
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Welt, in der sich Technologie und künstliche Intelligenz weiterentwickeln, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um Ihre Daten und Netzwerke vor Cyberrisiken zu schützen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.